This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
There's a new strategy unfolding in the Brian Koberger case, and it's got a lot of people going, Yeah, legal analysts, the media, the public, all taking a hard look at what might be one of the boldest death penalty defenses in recent history. Koberger's attorneys have officially now, we've been talking about this for weeks, but they have officially introduced a new argument that he has autism spectrum disorder, ASD. And because of this, he should not be sentenced to death if convicted. It's like we're jumping all the way there. We're not even at trial yet. We're like, hey, guys, just in case you do think he killed them, you shouldn't kill him. Okay? Like, not cool. Yeah. Now, let's be clear. They're not saying he's innocent. They're not claiming insanity. What they are saying is that his neurodevelopmental condition should legally disqualify him from the death penalty. It's a big swing, and it raises a whole list of questions. Can autism be used as a defense against capital punishment? Has this ever worked before? And what does it mean for the trial? The newly unsealed court filings, previously hidden away under layers of sealed motions and legal red tape, show the defense laying out their argument in careful, calculated terms. They claim that because Koberger is on the autism spectrum disorder, his behavior, his demeanor, and affect might not be what jurors expect from someone accused of murder. He may not show remorse the way they anticipate, or at all. He may not react emotionally the way they'd assume a guilty or innocent person would. And if the jury misinterprets his flat affect, his rigidity, his lack of normal emotion and expression, they could wrongfully sentence him to death based on fundamental misunderstandings of how his brain works. That's the crux of the argument. And if you think that sounds like a long shot, well, you're not alone. The prosecution is expected to push back hard against this, and for good reason. Idaho law, like most states, does not recognize autism or any mental disorder as a get-out-of-jail-free card when it comes to the death penalty. If you're convicted of a capital crime, your neurological condition doesn't matter. It does not exempt you from execution. The only mental health-related exemption that exists is for intellectual disabilities, which is very different. A totally different legal standard entirely. Autism isn't classified as an intellectual disability, because it's not. It can be a superpower. Can it make you slower on some things, or think differently on others, or act strange, or lack empathy? Yeah, it can do all that. But it is not something that is going to be looked at or should be looked at as some sort of intellectual disability. So right off the bat, this argument isn't exactly on solid legal ground. But the defense isn't trying to change Idaho law overnight. What they're doing is more nuanced. They're planting the seed that even if Koberger is convicted, he shouldn't be executed because his autism makes him particularly vulnerable to wrongful sentencing. It's a play not for exoneration, but for leniency. And in a case this high profile, where the death penalty is very much on the table, even the slightest shift in perception can be the difference between life and death. Maybe that's what they're fighting for now. Let's break this all down a little bit more. What does the science actually say about autism in criminal defense? Okay, this is in criminal defense. First, autism does not make someone more prone to violence. That is a misconception, a dangerous one, actually. There's no credible scientific evidence to suggest that people with autism are more likely to commit violent crimes. In fact, it could be the exact opposite. In fact, studies show that people in the spectrum are far more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators of it. It's not saying he couldn't have ASD and be a violent, repulsive human being who processes things in such a way that made him do something like this. I mean, if you look at the incel community out there, I bet almost all of them are on the spectrum. Does it make them right? Does it give them a pass to be pieces of shit? No. But that's the path they choose. You can make choices with ASD. You can, trust me. But what is relevant to this case is how people with autism process emotions, how they react under stress, and how their demeanor can be wildly misrepresented by people who don't understand ASD. Again, spectrum. Big. It's a kind of a catch-all. It really is. Koberger's defense team is betting on the idea that his behavior, his lack of visible emotion, his rigid body language, his monotone responses might be misread in jurors as cold and calculating, even sociopathic, which it can be. And they're worried that could tip the scales toward an unjust death sentence. Now, prosecutors are likely going to argue that this is a last-ditch effort to save Koberger from the death penalty. They'll point out that his defense has already tried to have the death penalty removed on other grounds, arguing Idaho's execution methods are unconstitutional, that prolonged death row conditions are cruel and unusual, and that the process itself is flawed. None of those arguments have worked so far. And so does this autism argument have any real chance? Well, there is precedent for using neurological conditions as mitigation in capital cases. But it's a tough road. Historically, courts have been very resistant to carving out exceptions for mental health conditions unless they meet the legal definition of intellectual disability. In fact, in 2002, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Atkins versus Virginia that excluding individuals with intellectual disabilities violates the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. That's the only real exception that exists under federal law. But autism, that is uncharted territory. Koberger's defense is hoping to expand that legal framework. They're trying to argue that autism is functionality and very functional. Similar in ways to intellectual disability when it comes to sentencing. Not quite, but good try. Especially in how it impacts emotional processing and perception. But even if a judge or jury finds that argument compelling, it still doesn't mean they'll strike the death penalty overnight. More likely, it would be considering a mitigating factor during sentencing rather than an absolute shield against execution. So let's play this out a little bit. If Koberger is convicted, and if the jury is tasked with deciding whether he gets life in prison or the death penalty, the defense will almost certainly bring in expert witnesses, psychologists, forensic specialists, autism researchers, who will testify that his ASD makes him neurologically different in a way that should spare his life. They'll argue that executing someone who perceives the world differently is unjust. Look, if you're on the spectrum, you do know right from wrong. You may laugh at things that are a little bit different than others at a dinner conversation. Or not laugh at all when others are finding something hilarious. You may sometimes misinterpret someone's words to you. But it is not going to make you somehow think, I should go kill 4 college students today. That seems like a great idea. That is not being on the spectrum. That's just being a sociopath or a psychopath. Now, can you have ASD and be a sociopath and a psychopath? Yes, you can. But it does not in any way, shape, or form make you think that that is a right thing to do. To go kill people. There's nothing on that that's going to go, Murder seems like a lovely idea today. And here's where things get interesting. Public perception matters in these cases. And in the court of public opinion, this autism argument is already making waves. The media has seized on it with headlines ranging from Koberger's lawyer argue his autism should spare him from execution, to more skeptical takes on this, like, is this a desperate attempt to avoid the death penalty? The discussion has spilled over into social media, where reactions are mixed, some people sympathizing with the idea that autism could lead to misinterpretation, others calling it a calculated legal move that has nothing to do with Koberger's actual guilt or innocence. What do you guys think? Right now is a good time to remind you to press subscribe wherever you're listening to this. If you're in the podcast world, hit that subscribe button. If you're watching us on YouTube, hit that, hit the bell. And if you're on YouTube specifically, or if you're on a podcast platform that allows comments, what do you think of this? Should this be a factor in life or death for Brian Koberger? Be very interested to hear your take. The families of the victims in this case haven't made any public statements on this particular defense yet, but it's hard, or I should say it's not hard, to imagine how they might feel about it. They've been outspoken before about wanting justice, and they have repeatedly expressed frustration with legal delays and procedural motions. For them, this is another legal roadblock in a case that has already dragged on for more than 2 years. And let's not forget the jury in this case. The strategy is not much about perception as it is about legal precedent. The defense knows that if they can introduce even a sliver of doubt about how Koberger's brain works, if they can get one or two jurors to hesitate when deciding between life and death, that might be all they need. In a capital case, a single juror's reluctance to impose the death penalty can be the difference between execution and life without parole. But here's the thing. Even if the autism defense technically doesn't change the legal standard for execution, it does add another layer of complexity to an already complex case. It forces the court to grapple with something that hasn't been tested in Idaho's legal system before. And it forces the prosecution to rethink how they present Koberger to a jury. They can't just paint him as a cold and emotionless person without acknowledging that the defense will counter with, well, yeah, but he's autistic. Killing people is his hobby. Okay, they won't add that part in. So as we wait for the judge to rule on this motion, one thing very clear, the legal chess match in this case is not going to be over anytime soon. Whether or not the autism argument succeeds in striking the death penalty, it's already reshaping how this trial is being fought. And while the courtroom is still very much debating whether the public should even see some of these filings, one person who's clearly had enough of the secrecy is Judge Stephen Hippler. Over the past 2 weeks, he's put his foot down on a flood of sealed documents, making it clear that the trial is going to be fraught with public knowledge, with transparency. It'll be fought in the open, whether the attorneys like it or not. And that's exactly what we're going to talk about next. For months, the case has played out behind a wall of secrecy, sealed filings, closed-door hearings, and gag orders so strict that even the attorneys involved in the case have had to watch their words very carefully. But over the past 2 weeks, the man presiding over this legal circus, Judge Stephen Hippler, has finally had enough. It's a move that's been brewing for some time. Hippler has put his foot down on the excessive secrecy, making it crystal clear that he is not running a courtroom where every major decision is going to be locked away from public view. His frustration, which has been simmering under the surface for months, finally boiled over in his latest ruling, where he essentially called out both the prosecution and the defense for what he sees as an abuse of the sealing process. His message? Enough is enough, kids. Now, to be fair, sealing certain documents in a criminal trial is not unusual. It happens all the time, especially in high-profile cases where pretrial publicity could taint a jury pool. Sensitive information like witness identities, forensic evidence, and strategic legal arguments is something kept under wraps to ensure a fair trial. But in the Koberger case, the volume of sealed filings has reached a level that even the judge himself seems to find a bit excessive. Hitler's ruling makes it clear the court is done with this blanket secrecy. He has ordered that future filings must be made public by default, and only portions of documents can be sealed when absolutely necessary. What does this all mean? Well, that means we're finally going to get a deeper look at the legal maneuvering behind the scenes, what each side is arguing, how evidence is being challenged, and what motions are shaping the trial. Other than that, we've been under a big blanket of secrecy. Speculation. If something leaks out, we talk about it. This is a big shift, but it didn't come out of nowhere. The fight over transparency in this case has been brewing for months. And the ones leading that fight? The media. For over a year, journalists and legal analysts have been raising alarms over the sheer amount of secrecy in this case. News organizations have filed motions challenging the sealing of key court documents, arguing that the public has a right to know what's happening in a case of this magnitude. And it's not hard to see why. Since Koberger's arrest, major filings, including DNA challenges, death penalty motions, and key defense strategies have been kept under lock and key. Even now, some of the most significant legal arguments in this case have only been partially unsealed after pressure from the press. And that's made it incredibly difficult for the public to follow what's actually happening here. The judge himself acknowledged this problem in his ruling, pointing out that attorneys on both sides have been using sealing as a default option rather than the exception. That's not how this is supposed to work. In most cases, sealing is reserved for situations where public disclosure would pose a legitimate risk to the integrity of the trial, not just because an attorney prefers to keep something under wraps. So what does this ruling actually mean? First, it means that we are about to see a whole lot more of what's actually happening in the case. Future filings, including motions, responses, and court orders, will be made public unless a judge specifically rules that a portion of them should be sealed. That means fewer redacted documents, fewer blacked out pages, and a lot more transparency about the legal arguments that are shaping this trial. Second, it means that the legal teams on both sides are going to have to be a lot more careful about what they file. Up until now, attorneys have been able to make bold, sweeping legal arguments behind closed doors without the public ever seeing the details. Now, every motion, every objection, and every piece of legal strategy that doesn't involve highly sensitive information is going to be out in the open. That's a big shift. It's going to force both the prosecution and defense to rethink how they handle pre-trial motions going forward. But here's the big question. Will this actually help or hurt Koberger's chances at a fair trial? On one hand, the defense might argue that unsealing these filings increases the risk of pretrial bias. After all, one of the biggest concerns has been the level of public scrutiny that this case has already received. And they're not wrong. Koberger's arrest, the DNA evidence, the surveillance footage of his car, all of it has been dissected endlessly in the media. Every new development gets turned into a headline. And the fear, at least from the defense's perspective, is that by the time a jury is seated, they'll already have their minds made up. That's one of the reasons the gag order was put in place in the first place, to limit what attorneys and law enforcement could say publicly about the case. That order is still in effect, meaning that even though more documents will be public, prosecutors and the defense, in this case, can't talk with the media. But make no mistake, unsealing these filings changes the game. Even without direct statements from the attorneys, legal analysts and the press are going to have a lot more material to work with when breaking down this case. And the more the public knows, the harder it becomes to find a jury that hasn't already been influenced by the narrative playing out in court filings. On the other hand, greater transparency might actually help both sides. How? Well, for the prosecution, it means that their strongest evidence, their best arguments, and their response to the defense's challenges will be fully visible to the public. That could help them push back against any claims that this case is built on shaky evidence or unfair legal tactics. In fact, prosecutors might welcome this level of openness because it gives them the chance to demonstrate just how solid their case really is. For the defense, it could serve as a check against the prosecution's power. If the state tries to introduce evidence that's legally questionable, The public will see those arguments unfold in real time. That makes it harder for the prosecution to pull any last-minute legal maneuvers that go unchecked. And if Carberger's defense team believes he's being treated unfairly, then they can point to specific court filings to make their case. But beyond just this trial, this ruling could have major implications for other high-profile cases as well. Secrecy in the judicial system has always been a controversial issue, and the way this case is handled could set a precedent for how courts balance the public's right to know with a defendant's right to a fair trial. If Hitler's crackdown on the sealed filings leads to greater openness without compromising the trial's integrity, it could serve as a blueprint to other judges handling high-profile cases. But if the increased transparency leads to a media circus that makes it impossible to seat an impartial jury, it could become an example of why some secrecy is necessary in cases of this magnitude. So what next? Well, in the immediate future, we're going to start seeing a lot more of what's happening behind the scenes. Key motions that were previously hidden from the public, including defense challenges, prosecution responses, and the judge's rulings, are going to start surfacing. And with each new document that gets unsealed, we're going to get a clearer picture of how the case is being fought in the courtroom. But with that new transparency comes a whole new challenge: navigating the war over evidence, testimony, and the rules of engagement for this trial. Because while the judge may have had enough of the secrecy, both sides are still gearing up for a brutal pretrial battle over what the jury will actually be allowed to see and hear. It's already been going on. And if you thought the fight over sealed documents was intense, just wait till you see the battle over language, evidence, and how Carberger is presented in front of a jury. There's a reason attorneys fight over every single word that gets said in a courtroom. In a case like this, one word can shape how a jury sees the entire trial. And right now, Brian Carberger's defense team is on a mission to keep two very specific words out of the courtroom altogether: psychopath or sociopath. ASD sounds a lot nicer, doesn't it? Well, you may be diagnosed with ASD, Mr. Carberger, but that doesn't preclude you from being a psychopath or a sociopath. Yeah. They can coexist. They've officially filed a motion asking the judge to ban the use of these labels during the trial, arguing that they're inflammatory, unscientific, and designed to make Carberger look like a monster. And honestly, well, maybe they got a point. Although to say that it's unscientific is not truly true. They are official words that are used to diagnose psychopaths. There are specific qualifications to get the diagnosis. There are specific qualifications to get a sociopathic diagnosis. Neither psychopath nor sociopath, you know, is used in ways that we all truly understand it. It's thrown out far too frequently. They're pop culture buzzwords in a lot of ways. More at home in true crime documentaries and thriller novels than in a courtroom. Legally speaking, they're meaningless, but that doesn't mean they don't carry tremendous weight to a jury. Say those words in the wrong context, and suddenly the defendant isn't just a man on trial. He's a Hollywood villain, Hannibal Lecter, or Ted Bundy. And maybe he is. That's what the defense is worried about. They know how easily labels like this can turn the defendant into something more than human or less than human, something jurors won't hesitate to destroy. It's one thing to argue that Carberger's guilt or innocence is based on evidence. It's another to let the prosecution frame him as inherently dangerous, as if his alleged crimes were preordained by his very nature. That's why the defense wants those words gone. But what if it's true? Here's the thing. The prosecution doesn't actually need to use those words. If the judge grants the motion and rules that psychopath and sociopath are off limits, that doesn't mean the prosecution can't still build the exact same narrative. They'll just have to do it without saying those specific words. Instead of calling him a psychopath, they can describe him as cold, emotionless, detached, methodical. Instead of labeling him a sociopath, they can focus on his alleged lack of empathy, how he stalked his victims, how he executed a carefully planned crime, which some may say sounds far worse. And if they play it right, they don't need to say the word at all. The jury will fill in the blanks for them. It's like Mad Libs. So while the motion matters, it's really just a battle over framing. And the judge's decision will determine how much work the prosecution has to do that paint the picture without right saying it. But wordplay isn't the only fight happening in the courtroom. The real war is over what the jury will and won't be allowed to hear. Right now, one of the key battles is over an indictment, or an incident rather, from 2014 when Koberger was accused of stealing a cell phone from his own sister. His defense team has filed a motion to keep this completely out of trial, arguing that it's irrelevant, ancient history, and has no bearing on the murders he's currently charged with. Legally speaking, they've got a strong argument here. Bringing up a petty theft from over a decade ago could be seen as prejudicial. It's not evidence, it's just character assassination. That's the exact kind of thing that can lead to an appeal if the jury convicts. Juries tend to be very cautious about letting in prior bad acts unless they're directly relevant to the case. A misdemeanor-level incident from Koberger's teenage years, that's a tough sell. What this motion, and why this motion is interesting, is why the prosecution might even want to introduce it in the first place. The theft itself is not the point. It's the pattern of behavior they want to establish. The prosecution may try to argue that even back then, Koberger showed signs of manipulation, deceit, and disregard for social norms. But unless they can tie it directly to the crimes at hand, it's probably not making it in for the jury. Another key issue being fought right now, who gets to sit in the courtroom? The prosecution has filed a motion regarding the presence of victims' families at trial, and this could have major implications for the atmosphere inside that courtroom. In cases like this, victims' family members have a legal right to be present, but the defense may argue that their presence, especially in large numbers, could have a psychological impact on the jury. Yeah, you're damn right it will, and it should. It's one thing to listen to evidence and testimony in a vacuum. It's another to hear it while sitting a few feet away from a grieving parent or sibling. It's a delicate issue because sequestering victims' families could backfire. Jurors might wonder why the family isn't here. They might see it as a move by the defense to erase the victims from the courtroom, which could stir resentment. So the judge has to walk a fine line here, allowing the families to be present while ensuring their presence does not unduly influence the jury's emotions. The prosecution wants them there. The defense wants limitations on when and where they can sit. And the judge, he's the one who has to decide how much human emotion belongs in a courtroom that's supposed to deal only in facts. Then, of course, there's the ongoing war over evidence. The defense is still accusing the prosecution of withholding key information, and they filed yet another motion demanding that certain materials be turned over. It's not the first time they've made this claim, and it probably won't be the last, even if it's not real. What exactly are they asking for? The part? Well, that's not entirely clear yet, at least not in public filings, but in past disputes, the defense has demanded more detailed DNA analysis, additional forensic reports, and even internal communications between investigators. Their argument is that the state is holding back information that could be crucial to their case, whether intentionally or not. The prosecution, of course, denies any wrongdoing. They say they've handed over everything they're legally required to provide. And here's where it gets even more messy, because if the defense truly believes that evidence is, in fact, being hidden, they could push for more aggressive measures, like requesting an evidentiary hearing or even filing for sanctions against a prosecution, and that would be a major escalation. So where does this leave us now? Where are we at? Well, with the trial date set for August of 2025, the battle lines are being drawn right now. So pre-trial motions and hearings are some of the most important in a trial, A lot of it gets decided before the trial even starts. Every single one of these pretrial rulings is going to shape who sits on the jury, what they hear, and how they interpret the case. If the judge bans words like psychopath and sociopath, the prosecution will have to be more creative in how they frame Koberger's alleged mindset. If the 2014 cell phone theft incident is excluded, the state loses one small tool in their arsenal to paint a picture of Koberger's past behavior. If the victims' families are allowed full access to the courtroom, their presence could be a powerful visual reminder to the jury of the lives that were lost. And if the defense succeeds in their ongoing discovery disputes, they could gain access to evidence that might fundamentally change their strategy. None of these rulings are blockbuster decisions on their own, but together they create the framework for the trial that's about to unfold. Because once the jury is seated and once opening statements begin, there won't be any more time for legal arguments behind closed doors. That's when everything moves into the courtroom. That's when you're on stage. That's when the fight over words, over evidence, over perception become a fight for conviction or acquittal. And that's when we finally see how all of these battles add up to the war itself. We'll keep following it for you. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you are watching this or listening to this. If it's on YouTube, hit subscribe. Comment, tell us what you think on this case and where it is heading and where it's at. If you're on the podcast channels, press subscribe there. And be sure to check us out and let your friends know that we exist. Greatly appreciate that. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening.
The latest true crime stories, expert breakdowns, and shocking twists all in one place. Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. You just made it through an episode of Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Congrats on surviving the ads. Want to skip them completely next time?
What is that?
Join the True Crime Today Premium Plus channel on Apple Podcasts. Ad-free episodes, exclusive early access, and no interruptions. Just pure crime storytelling. Try it free for 3 days. Don't wait.
Bitchin' stuff. Dude.
Hit subscribe now on Apple Podcasts and get ahead of the mystery.
You know what I'm saying?